This is Walter Cronkite reporting from Zurich, Switzerland, a city which has, on more than one occasion, provided sanctuary for the political exiles and refugees of the world. On June 17, 1974, 1 week ago tonight, this reporter spoke with the latest and most celebrated of those political exiles, the Russian writer Alexander Solzhenitsyn. This is his first extended television interview since his forcible exile from the Soviet Union last February.
I know, in reality, that I've known the Soviet life for the whole of my life. Today, I haven't lost my Soviet point of view. This is the way it is. International détente does nothing to help the situation inside the Soviet Union. Tell me, please, let's be realists. What kind of guarantees are there that the treaties will be fulfilled today or tomorrow? And when your businessmen conclude in alliance with our leaders, say that trade guarantees peace, that's obvious to a child it's not true. It doesn't guarantee anything. On the contrary, trade goes on so long as there is peace. And when there isn't peace, there won't be any trade. Therefore, so what could guarantee? What guarantees could there be? From where can you get the warning voices? Only from our dissidents.
We spoke for 1 hour and 40 minutes with Solzhenitsyn. This hour is edited from that film, Conversation. This is a CBS News special. Solzhenitsyn, with CBS News correspondent Walter Cronkite. In February 1974, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, 56 years old, became the first Russian to be forcibly exiled from the Soviet Union since Leon Trotsky in 1929. He was flown to West Germany. In late March, his wife and family joined him in Zurich. This is the Solzhenitsyn family in Zurich today. His second wife, Natalia Svetlova, is 34. His son, Yermolai, is 3. Ignat is 21 months. Stepan is 9 months. Also with them is his stepson, Dmitry, 12. And his mother-in-law, Yekaterina Svetlova, 55. Solzhenitsyn is compared today with Russia's greatest writers, Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, Pushkin, Turgenev. A Nobel Prize winner in 1970, he's written 6 books that led to his expulsion. Books of rage against Soviet repression. One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, 1962. The Cancer Ward, 1968. The First Circle, 1968. Stories and Prose Poems, 1971. August 1914, published in 1972. The Gulag Archipelago, 1918-1956, published in the United States this month. The archipelago symbolizes the network of prison camps dotted like islands across the length and breadth of the Soviet Union. Solzhenitsyn's books are said to have earned him millions of dollars in royalties. In Zurich today, Solzhenitsyn works on March 1917, the third volume of the trilogy with August 1914 and October 1916. For security reasons, he and his family ask us not to show the residential street on which they live or the exterior of their modest house. In this hour, he talks about his writing, his ordeal in the Soviet Union, his views of the United States and of the world, and of his hopes for the future.
Mr. Solzhenitsyn, after 4 months in Western Europe, have you revised any of your opinions which were formed back in the Soviet Union about the Western world?
комиссаре, вы уже 4 месяца в Западной Европе. Вы пересмотрели какие-то из своих мнений о западном мире?
Четыре месяца, это, конечно, срок вообще небольшой.
You know, 4 months is, of course, a very short period, especially with my way of life. I don't travel with much, I don't meet people. I try to get on with my work, so that my experience of the West is very small. But I'd like to say, no, my main views, as they were formed, have remained as they were. I would even say that my views are not individual views. They correspond with those of many people living in the Soviet Union and in Eastern Europe.
Your work in the Soviet Union must have, of course, been very difficult in many ways. Now with the freedom to work, is that likely to affect the attitude with which you approach your work, perhaps?
You know,
I never, when I was working in the Soviet Union, the pressure on me from outside, that was pressure on my life, not on my work. I started seriously working in the camp in the Primavera 48, but there, every day, I had to think about what I'd written. Where could I hide it? But then maybe somebody would come at night. But here, I can write it, put it away, and go to sleep peacefully.
How difficult has it been for your family to adjust, the children and your wife, to life outside of Russia?
Конечно, трудно. Конечно, семья моя.
Of course, it's been difficult. Of course, my family, well, it's not easy for anybody to get used, especially when this happens so suddenly. But we aren't really inclined to accustom ourselves. We're busy with our work. I'm busy up to my eyes in work. And ahead is the prospect of returning to Russia. We're in contact with Russia every day. We feel close. But we've had no intention of getting used in the way, but we believe that we shall return to Russia.
Have any idea when?
When? Unfortunately, people can never forecast when.
Does that necessitate a change in the political system, or just the political government at the moment?
Yes, the system must be changed. For me, there's a pretty simple key. The system should change sufficient to allow the Gulag Archipelago to be published freely and widely in Russia. Not the kind of deceptive publication that we have.
In other words, the day that Alexander Solzhenitsyn's works go on free sale in the bookstores of Russia, that's the day that you'll be able to go home.
Yes.
At that time, I could be useful. That would be the right moment.
Do you have any concern about your safety?
Нет, вы видите, я там был до последнего дня.
No. See, I was there till the very last day. I should never have left there of my own accord. Moreover, if I'd been concerned about my own safety, I wouldn't have dared to publish Gulag while I was still in the Soviet Union. I realized what it would mean for me to print Gulag. It was either death or death through prison. There was nothing else for it. And that's the way it happened. They arrested me. They charged me with being a traitor, which involved the death penalty, a shooting. So on the very first evening of my arrest, they told me I would be shot. I was ready for it. There was no other way of getting out of the situation. I couldn't leave the country. I couldn't hold on to Gulag forever. It had to be printed. So I really put my life at risk. That's the way it was.
I wondered what your opinion was of the Western media since you've been out.
I have to say that the Western press helped me and Sakharov and all of us to hold out for years.
and particularly helped in August and September of last year. It was then that in alliance with the Western press we won an important battle. So, of course, I could only be grateful to the Western press. But if we should speak objectively, if you want the views of an outsider, which is sometimes can see things a bit better than the people who live on the spot, here are a few of my impressions. Now, here I arrive with this little bit of bread from the Lefortovo prison in Moscow, my last uneaten meal from Lefortovo. I arrive suddenly in Western Europe. Only 3 hours before, I'd been threatened with execution. Suddenly, they tell me they'd throw me out and dump me in Frankfurt am Main. And practically from that minute, the Western press begins to invade me. I can hardly understand exactly what happened. It was as though I'd come with ready statements to make. But the only statement that I could make was that I made and said enough there, and now I'd be silenced. But the press wouldn't leave me alone. They pursued me everywhere. They hung around my house, then around my lawyer's house. I wanted to go out at night to get a bit of fresh air. At night, on my back balcony. All of a sudden, two Klieg lights on me. People were taking photographs of me. I go with my friend for a walk. They stick a microphone up to me. Listen to what I'm saying to my friends. And I bawled out, look, you're worse than the secret police in Russia. Then the press says, my first statement in the West was to say that the Western press is worse than the KGB. It was as though I was trying to praise the KGB. I had wanted to say, look, understand me. I just can't do it. Let me have a rest. Let me talk to my friend. No. It went on for a long time when I came back from Norway, when my family arrived, tired, exhausted. They wanted us to pose for them. Well, we couldn't pose for them. Then they ruined everything, ruined the flower beds around our house. Jumped on everything. So, I said, but gentlemen, why did you do this? I never thought. I do ask you. I'm not going to talk now. So they asked me, so we can't leave you, they would say. We are ordered to do it. If we don't do it, we shall be sacked. Well, you know, that's a very slippery and dangerous argument. If I don't carry it out, they're going to sack me. Any kind of policeman in the Soviet Union can say that. If I don't do it, I'll be sacked. You see, every profession must put its restraints on itself. Every person must put some restraint on himself. Honestly, the Western press is really not stopped by anything. No, the police, nobody can stop them, keep them off a person. Not the government, nothing seems to interfere with them. Well, in that case, you simply have to restrain yourself. This is really a moral sin. You must drop it. Other people are trampling on blood, but I won't. Other people pursue a man, but I won't. Every good quality. If they aren't restrained in some way, become vices. It would be possible to admire this. The determination to extract the truth without bothering about anybody else. Ready to go into battle. That means I don't mind dying so long as I get hold of the story. Strange is when this Western press gets to Moscow or to Eastern Europe. or even to China, for example.
Вот поразительное явление. А там западная пресса совершенно не...
But this is a very extraordinary thing. There, the Western press changes completely. There are one or two remarkable exceptions. There are certain correspondents who aren't afraid. But they get sent out of the country. But the great majority of them, they suddenly, those very men who hear nothing will stop, they become there so modest and so cautious and so very careful. Here, there's nothing is sacred for them. They go as presidents, military, ministries and so forth. But there, if some miserable Bulgarian policeman tells them not to photograph a church, they stop. Or the Red Guard, you know, the Red Guards in China. They hang up some kind of leaflet, and a correspondent comes up to read it. And some wretched little Red Guard tells him not to read it. Correspondent turns and walks away. Why is it so different?
You criticized the manners and the behavior of the American press, particularly in your own case. But you're not suggesting, are you, that you dislike the system of freedom of press in this in the Western world?
Не только не критикую систему свободы прессы.
Not only do I not criticize the system of freedom of the press. On the contrary, I consider it one of the great good things of the Western world life. I have only two criticisms to make. On the one hand, it's not only the press, but every profession must know how to make use of its freedom, but to set some kind of a limit. Beyond this, I'm stepping over the moral limit. Externally, the press must be absolutely free, as it is with you, but internally, one must know where to draw the line. And on the other hand, I insist that if the press has such freedom in the West, then it must carry the same kind of freedom when it gets into the East.
Well, presumably, this is the principal purpose in your writing Gulag and your other works, is to try to bring the truth of what has happened behind what we call the Iron Curtain to the West.
I can't say that I wrote all these things in order to open the eyes of the West to Russia. I wrote them primarily for my own people in Russian, because we just don't know our own history. That's what's so frightful. Only the West knows our history. We have lost it, I told you. Recent events, before the revolution, time the revolution, materials being destroyed, witnesses have died. I tried to restore the truth. I worked for many years. If it hadn't been for the miracle that Ivan Denisovich, that Twardovsky managed to persuade Khrushchev to have it published, I saw my life, I would write to my very death, write everything, and then I would die. Nobody would. But thanks to Ivan Denisovich, I was able to have my things published in the West. If Khrushchev had known that I was writing the history of the revolution, he would never have let Ivan Denisovich be printed. He did it. Because he was quarreling with China over Stalin. Neither I nor anybody else suspected what consequences it would have.
If Khrushchev made a mistake in permitting the publication of Denisovich, has not perhaps Brezhnev made a mistake in exiling you and bringing all this added publicity to Gulag?
Ну, он не добавил мне этим никакого... Тем, что он меня изгнал,
By exiling me, He didn't add anything for me. By persecuting me in the Soviet was sufficient. He made sufficiently clear my position. No, yes. They committed a very big mistake in that when I wrote the letter to them, I explained that they have false objectives. I tried to persuade them to realize they have a false objective, which has forced them not only not to print the Gulag, not only to exile me, but even to sentence me to death. But they so badly understand the situation that they were afraid to print the cancer ward, which is perfectly easy to publish. In very dramatic circumstances, they offered me to publish the cancer ward in the Soviet Union.
Well, how did Gulag ever get published while you were still in the Soviet Union?
Когда уже Archipelag.
When the Gulag Archipelag, when the very day when I knew that it had been seized by the secret police, I immediately gave instructions that it should be printed in the West.
The Archipelago was supposed to be published while I was in the Soviet Union, but according to my plans, it was supposed to come out in the spring of 1975.
You see, I finished the Archipelago Gulag in 1968, but I decided that I would work for a few years and write some of the volumes of my history of the revolution, because these are two connected things. Without the revolution, there wouldn't have been the archipelago, and the archipelago comes out of the revolution. And since the history of the revolution nobody knows in our country, I thought that I would do some work on that, and the two things could be published together. That was it. I intended to be in the Soviet Union when it was published, in the spring of 1975. But, unfortunately, the archipelago got into the hands of the police. How did that happen? Well, it happened through Varanyanskaya. She helped me many years before. She helped me to type the draft version of Archipelago Gulag. That version she kept and took care of it. And then when I had the final version, I told her that she should destroy it. She lived in Leningrad, I lived in Moscow or nearby. That I said she had to destroy it, but she refused. She gave various reasons. She said it was in the ground, she said it was winter. The second time I said, no, you must destroy it. I can't be sure of preserving it. The second time she refused. The third time I told her to destroy it, and she literally, in 1972, she wrote me a letter in which she very dramatically described how she had burnt it, page by page. I believed her, but she deceived me, poor woman, because she thought that she would save the archipelago Gulag, even if I lost it. But she would have preserved it. Well, so the whole thing turned out for the worst. She was so devoted to it. She was afraid that I might not preserve it, and it might be lost. And so she preserved it. In this way, she fell under suspicion. How could the secret police get onto her trail? For a long time she'd not worked with me. She hadn't had anything with me. There'd be no letters, no work for me. Who knew her? She was known by two or three folk, that's all, just two or three folk. She was known by my former wife, Rishitovskaya. But Rishitovskaya knew nothing recently about her. But the past event she knew quite well. Recently the secret police had been close to my former wife. She'd been having talks with her, interrogating her.
You know, they asked her about Gulag. I just didn't want to think that she would do it out of a spirit of vengeance. But she warned me, and she let it know that she would take vengeance on me. I thought she wouldn't do it over my things. But maybe out of carelessness, she simply said something, showed photographs, and in that way, Baranyamskaya was arrested. But the fact that the secret police had not heard about it earlier, when the secret police actually read it, and then the authorities read it, their hands must have burnt. They must have trembled, because they didn't expect anything of such force. And so, for this reason, I returned to Cancer Ward. The 3 weeks after I'd given instructions for Gulag to be published, my wife phoned me and wanted to meet me. That's my former wife. But we met at the Ryazan station. She spoke on behalf of the secret police that some important person wanted to speak to me. I refused, but then she said, all right, they propose what? This. If you make a statement, public statement, that for 20 years you will not publish Gulag Archipelag, then they will let you publish Cancer Ward immediately. So it was only then, when they had Gulag in their hands, that they realized what it was. I had to deceive the secret police for another three months. I didn't know what they might do in the meantime. I said, all right, then I won't print it for the time being, as long as nothing happens to my 2,200 witnesses. She said, the witnesses won't be affected, but the people who helped you, and those who helped are those people close to me of former times, I follow very closely what happened to those people and what will happen to them in the Soviet Union now.
With the vaunted power of the secret police, why was it possible for them to simply go to your quarters and the quarters of your friends and seize the manuscript of Gulag?
Видите, в 65-м году
In 1965, they seized my archives, but they couldn't take Gulag, because as soon as they took my archives, it wasn't with me. Within 3 hours, Gulag was away from me. And then I traveled to a distant spot, the time when I got rid of my beard, so as to travel without being recognized. And it was there. I finished Archipelag in another place. But later, after my letter to the Writers' Congress, they simply didn't dare to come near me, to come for me. Right to the very end, they didn't dare. Until they decided to exile me. They just didn't dare.
I noticed your handwriting is very, very small. You could probably get the whole Gulag Archipelago as printed in a very few pages.
You know, this is an unfortunate experience. I had to write in with such small writing. Not only had to do the Gulag, but the whole of my works could be contained in a small box. The whole of my collected works could be carried by you without being noticed. I wrote from top to the bottom of the page and from one side to the other. Only like that I could do it.
You speak of the importance of the opinion in the West. Is it this Western opinion that is causing a greater wave of emigration now? For instance, the Panoffs last week, did they get out because of Western pressure?
Western public opinion has tremendous, huge influence. I wrote last year from the Soviet Union, I published a thing. In an interview, I said that in the West, the West doesn't really understand how great its influence is. When the combined voice of a whole continent, when two or three intellectuals of the West give, I protest that I don't believe in the strength of my protest, but when you get the combined voice of, well, then I and Sakharov, we could have been squashed without Western public opinion. But you raised the Panoffs and so. I will tell you, here there is a sort of distortion in the attention which the West gives to Soviet problems. This distortion comes because of the distorted picture which the West doesn't properly understand the Soviet Union. The strength increase in emigration has been achieved thanks to Western public opinion. Case of Panels and others should. But what has happened? Sort of unnoticed, all the best efforts of Western public opinion trying to help people in the Soviet Union was directed towards making emigration easier. And they've achieved that. So it looks like this, that the most important is to make emigration easier, whereas in reality, Western public opinion could ease the situation of those who don't want to emigrate, but those who, at the risk of their own life, want to improve the situation there in Russia. I, of course, as you understand, consider that every person wants to emigrate or to be able to emigrate. Every obstacle to emigration is a barbarity in a civilized country. But those people who emigrate are really fleeing from the country. There are a lot more braver people who stay in their country and try to improve the situation there, to set about improving. Why don't they get attention from the West? One day in a psychiatric ward, one day in a prison can be much worse than going day after day to the exit department to apply for a visa.
Do you think it's unpatriotic for those who wish to flee the Soviet Union to save their lives?
Look, I would put it this way. I would say, yes, if a man leaves the Soviet Union who feels that the country is alien to him, and it's not his real country, then it's a perfectly natural act of a free man. He wants to go and live in another country, and I certainly don't condemn him. Moreover, people who go to Israel, and really go to Israel, not to those who pretend that they're going to Israel but really go somewhere else, but those who say they really go to Israel, I respect them, because they are choosing for themselves a very much more difficult life in Israel. It will be more dangerous, and there'll be more duties for them to fulfill. They are moved by religious feelings and feelings of national renaissance. I have great respect for them. This is a patriotic move. I cannot respect those people who say like this: this is my country, this is my native land, so that's the Soviet Union, but I don't like it here. I'm going to leave it, and I won't stay here. And there, from the West, I'll explain to you what you ought to do, and I'll tell you how to go on. And then, if things improve, I'll come back. Then, when things are bad at home, and there's illness there, and misfortune, then you don't leave home. You can leave home when everything's all right there. That's the way I see it.
you see Soviet repression as a threat to world peace?
Yes. I consider that repression in the Soviet Union, by its very nature, is by no means an internal matter of the Soviet Union. I consider that Soviet repression, it has an international significance. It's a danger for the whole world. We talk so much now about détente. As if this détente was an improvement in the atmosphere everywhere. No. By according to my very latest information, which I received in the last week, the situation in the Soviet Union is getting worse. Even in the very last week, just really a letter from the last people who were getting in their way, so to reduce the pressure. So in future it won't be so easy to get out of there. And that they will be persecuting people more. Of course, I feel this very badly as far as it concerns people who are close to me. There is now a new concept in the Soviet Union. A friend of Solzhenitsyn is a criminal. It's as though it were an article of the criminal code. A friend of Solzhenitsyn is a criminal. They can give him academician Shaparevich, a mathematician, the winner of international prizes, who has just been elected to the American Academy. They don't dare to suppress him at the moment. And the Chukovskis also benefit from their distinguished father. For example, people very close to my friend, one man, Vadim Borisov, who is the godparent of my children, whose statements have been published in the West, he is now threatened on all sides. Why? Because a friend of Solzhenitsyn means he's also an enemy of the people. You have to understand the situation. Nobody talks about bugging. Everybody's bugged on all sides. The question of breaking into a doctor's office to find medical records, nobody would do it. There'd be no need to break in. Any authority could simply tell the doctor he'd have to hand the records over. Everything's on a different scale, a different condition. Barabanov, very well known man. He's now threatened with being called an idler or with arrest. And Alexander Gorlov, that time I wrote about him at one time, the time when there was a raid on my country house. He was told to shut up, but he wouldn't. He's not a dissident, he's never made any public statements, but he's just not one of their people. He just wouldn't keep quiet, he told me, and for that reason he's persecuted by the police. And now, after my departure, he's been threatened. This is the situation in which my friends have found themselves. In Russia, in the Soviet Union, the family of political prisoners are also persecuted. But if somebody sits in prison, if I've been in prison, I know that my family will be hungry and without clothes. This is a very special totalitarian way of repression. There is a certain Alexander Ginsberg. He's very well known. In his day, he published a white book on the case of Sinyavsky. Galanskov, his friend, died in the camp, but Ginsberg came out. He's free, but he's very sick. He's just a very remarkable man. He is now a sort of encyclopedia and knows whom has to be helped. So we have organized here in the West a Russian social fund.
here all the royalties from the Gulag Archipelago will go into that fund, and also royalties from other of my works. Maybe perhaps other people will make contributions. And so, with this money, we will try to help the families of the political prisoners in the Soviet Union. We're not doing a single illegal step, all strictly according to Soviet law. Nevertheless, as soon as it became known that it would be done through Ginsburg, they started to persecute him.
And even though it is legal under the form of the law, what makes you believe that the Soviet authorities will for 1 minute let anybody distribute that fund in the Soviet Union?
Because they will persecute those who receive the money. But in spite of the fact that Ginsburg is being persecuted, he carries on with the work. And even if they maltreat him, destroy him, others will do the work. This work, of course, it involves very great risks.
You said that you do not think that détente helps this situation at all. I gather then you're not very enthusiastic about President Nixon's visit to the Soviet Union.
This is the way it is. You know, Nixon recently said something like this. He said that there was a long time since there was a situation which was so close to lasting peace as today. He said something like that. I must say that this kind of optimism is completely incomprehensible to me. What is deceptive here, where you can make a mistake, is it seems as though the two conflicts which threatened the world have died down, the one in Vietnam and the one in the Middle East. Well, the one in the Middle East seems to die down really well, thank God for that. As for Vietnam, the conflict has not ceased, it's just an illusion. In the course of the armistice, more Vietnamese died than Americans in the whole war, what kind of a peace can that be? It's temporarily stopped, and it'll start again one day. So these two points are a conflict of stock, but they don't decide the future. The future is going to be decided by the general situation, and the general situation is, just before Nixon's visit. Never before has the superiority of the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact over the countries of NATO been so great as it is at the moment. If previously the superiority was in ground forces, in tanks, now, according to the latest estimates of your experts, the superiority is in nuclear weapons and missiles. Never before, this is a second factor, has the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe received such a mass of high-class technical equipment as before. We never got enough of this proper technical equipment. Third thing, never before has the President of the United States been in such a weak position as he is at the moment. He is now so weak that he does not have the strength to dictate to the Soviet Union. And in any case, the old treaties are still not being carried out. The general agreement about Western Berlin is being violated. The treaty on nuclear arms restrictions also being violated. Your president does not have the sufficient strength to demand proper control of these treaties. This is the case.
In your letter to the Soviet leaders, you favored an authoritarian system for the Soviet Union, and this This brought considerable criticism from some of your fellow dissidents, and I think some disappointment, perhaps, on the part of liberals in the West. Can you straighten out your views on that?
My letter to the leaders of the Soviet Union was really very incorrectly understood in the West, partly because in America and England it was published without the foreword. There were always different systems, and in my letter to the leaders, I dealt exclusively and only with Russian subjects. What is necessary for what we can do in Russia? And secondly, what can be done in present conditions and definitely without revolution? I tried to seek a way by which we in Russia now could find a way of softening the totalitarian system, but at least leave it, but at least soften it. But now, for Russia today, another revolution would be worse than 1917. The number of people who would die and the productive forces that would be destroyed. There's no other way for us in Russia. But that doesn't mean that I, in general, think that there should be a totalitarian system and that it's better than a democratic system. Yes, I even criticize the democratic system as well, in this letter and elsewhere. I commented as I saw it from the Soviet Union.
Well, isn't it possible that having been behind the curtain in the Soviet Union, that you don't fully understand the American democracy either? For instance, you said, I think in your letter, I believe, in that criticism of the democratic system of which you spoke, you said that the election every 4 years is an attempt at gratifying the masses. And in the Ellsberg acquittal, you referred to the judge pandering to the passions of society. Well, now, that's really, I think, in the American view, what democracy is all about, is gratifying the masses and pandering to society.
Well, it's not right to say that I haven't noticed the good sides of American democracy. I've noticed a lot of good sides to American democracy, but when we're talking together publicly, we just can't go on endlessly praising each other and paying each other compliments. We normally criticize. But in general terms, it seems to me that now the governments of the major democracies are in a great danger. Democracy itself is in great danger. The governments are really so unstable. In two or three votes seem to decide the whole course of policy. It seems that the half of the country is one side and half the country on the other. The most important questions are being decided in this way.
Well, how do you see America's role in the world today?
The United States won the world wars and decided the outcome of the wars. The United States twice raised Europe from the ruins. The United States throughout the world helped in all cases of famine, flooding, epidemics. The United States defended peace against Stalin on many occasions. The case of Western Berlin, the Berlin blockade in Korea, and in the Far East in general. That's what the United States did. What was the attitude of the world at large to that? The Americans never begged for their loans to be repaid, never made political conditions. They showed great generosity. What happened then to America? The cultural centers in America were being threatened and burnt. When America lost a vote in the United Nations, people of the Third World simply cheered. The most fashionable thing for politicians in the third world to do, and even in Europe, was to attack America. What is written about you in the Soviet press? Just, you don't have to pay any attention at all. There was a time when they gave instructions to the Soviet press to attack America as imperialists about to begin an atomic war. There was a time when they gave orders to talk about detente. There's American leaders arriving in Moscow. Another command is given. How many flags should be put out? How many people should be on the street? Who should stand where? So, just don't pay any attention to that sort of thing. That is done on the orders of the government. But believe me, I want to tell you that there exists, quite independently of this government policy, a strong, steady sympathy on the part of the Russian people to the American people. In spite of all the newspaper lies, in spite of all that, there is an internal sympathy on the part of the Russian people for the Americans. Although people are very ungrateful to America, there is, paradoxically, that your activity is very highly esteemed in Russia. But this doesn't necessarily give us any great hopes for the future, because we are not masters of our own fate for the time being. And in general, and in your country, and in our country, the future is not going to be an easy one. The great countries that don't have easy futures, easy fates, both with you and with us, there's a very difficult future ahead. Very serious dangers ahead, mainly internal dangers. I don't fear an international conflict, a nuclear conflict, but I believe that internally there are very great dangers ahead, both in the United States and in the Soviet Union.
Can we look forward at all to the possibility of an early visit from Mr. Solzhenitsyn to the United States?
You know, I would very gladly go there. But now, after this convulsion I've had to live through, this break in my life, which I now have to recreate, my thing of first importance to me is my work as a writer. I cannot break it off. I have to be convinced that my work is going on without halt. When I find it possible that my work wouldn't suffer from such a trip, and I must arrange it so that it wouldn't suffer, then I would go with very great pleasure.
We shall look forward to that. And thank you very much for this interview.